Okay, welcome to this meeting, this discussion meeting hosted by the Consistent Democrats. We're going to be speaking about, Paul is going to be doing a, probably a quite short presentation, I think, on the nature of centrism, which is sort of continuing a discussion we had several weeks ago. I will hand you over to Paul. Thank you, comrades. Paul.
I think, hi comrades, I think this talk may be somewhat redundant due to events, quite frankly, because I was going to link it to, I was going to try and link centrism to elements of your party, but it appears that I may actually be confusing centrism with bureaucratism, but nevertheless, I see where it goes and it may lead to a discussion. And as I say, events are either taking shape quite quickly, and I think my interpretation of what's going on in your party may somewhat be more cynical than some other comrades, so I guess that's where I'm coming from. With where it sort of started when there was all this talk. This is why I argue that it's an element of centrism. There was all this talk from various groups in the collective. That was the main group, and then there was others like Transform, which is currently in the process of deciding whether they join your party or not. But we saw from the start, from the WhatsApp groups, that was unfortunately leaked to the Times because there was a journal, a so-called journalist, already who was in the WhatsApp group at the time, and all this stuff on from WhatsApp got leaked to the Times. It became a faction fight between those that supported Corbyn and those that supported Zahra Sultana. Now, those that supported Zahra Sultana in this internal WhatsApp group were saying, come on, we've got to get on with this, or what did that affect? And it was around the time that Zahra Sultana had officially resigned from the Labour Party, and then she announced that she was, and then she joined the independent group of independent MP, which made it six, not five. And then she announced that she was going to be co-leading a party with Jeremy Corbyn. And Jeremy Corbyn and his entourage of people in the collective were like, hold on a minute, this wasn't what we agreed, and all this stuff. And they wanted to delay. And this is where my accusation of centrism comes in. And as events unfolded, you know, they were asking her to take it down, and she didn't. And then, about a week or two later, Jeremy Corbyn confirmed that he would be joining with Zahra Sultana to create what, for the moment at least, is called Your Party. Other forms of centrism I've seen in local WhatsApp groups is this idea that Well, there's an argument about whether other parties should be allowed to join. That's one argument, but the argument that I keep coming across is that we shouldn't allow their words, Marxist groupets to join the organisation. My concern about that is if we don't allow Marxist groups to organise within what is currently your party, then we will end up again with other forms of centrism, or should I say, perhaps a less shittier version than the current Labour Party. And again, that leads me on to another concern, and that is that there are some people currently involved in your party whose experience, they have no experience outside the Labour Party, or at least outside the Labour Party way of doing things. So the more centrist elements of that wing of your party is struggling to see outside the box sort of thing. And this is where, you know, I've tried to expand the idea of centrism to your party, but it's quite possible that, as Ian suggested to me privately, that perhaps I've confused centrism with bureaucracy. So I'll leave that there and see where that goes, and then maybe it can be a bigger discussion.
Yeah. Thanks. Okay. Can I just come in on this, if that's all right? Yeah. Because I think you sort of got confused in what you're talking about, Paul, in terms of what we're supposed to be talking about in this discussion, which is that centrism is something rather different to what you've just been laying out. I think centrism is... Let's be very clear that your party is not centrist, right? At the moment, it's not even a party yet. And it certainly isn't centrist. Its political profile is left reformist. And it's struggling to get established, you know. We all know this. Because although it gained a huge amount of support when it was first announced, up to 1 million people signed up to support it in some form or another. You know, when they've actually come to actually create the party, it became the subject of a factional war, you know, and I think you went through some of the things involved in that. But that was on a very low level, really. That was on the level of, yes, there were political differences, and they were expressed over questions like Zionism and the record of the Corbyn leadership of the Labour Party in capitulating to the witch hunt against the left over supposed anti-Semitism. And that is a subject of considerable controversy between Sultana and Corbyn. Because Corbyn has actually bitten back on that, on that criticism, and sort of said, "Well, I don't know why she said that," you know. But that's not what we're talking about here. I mean, the idea of this presentation was to talk about the possibilities of your party or something like it evolving beyond reformism, you know. And I think there are potentials for that, because despite all the bureaucratic bungles in the early days, there are sizable meetings of this party going on around the country, in various cities, in lots of different cities. I heard about a meeting in Whitstable in Kent this week that had 150 people at it. You know, now I know that's actually quite a small place. You know, it's not exactly a big metropolis. It's not even like Croydon, which also had a similar size meeting a few weeks ago, you know. But this is a sizeable organisation that, despite all its bungles and its false starts and its, you know, teething troubles, is actually growing, and it's actually becoming quite sizable. And it's having a pounding conference, which may or may not happen at the end of November. I'm not convinced it will happen in the way that they plan it, because I think the preparations are too slow, and it may end up being postponed somewhat. But it is mobilising a layer of the, not the far left, but a large layer of the Labour Party's former working class base, and former other base as well. You know, it's layers of activists and whatever. And it is beginning to sort of congeal into a significant organisation. Now, the question is, what happens when it goes out into the real world? What will happen to it? Because it's recruiting not just individual, Labour Party militants, etc., or people who have a record in the Labour Party, but it's recruiting a lot of people on the far left, you know, who are joining it. The SNP are basically have a position that they will join it as a whole. And a whole load of other left-wing groups are actually saying that, although in practice they're not necessarily doing that, you know. So it's going to have rather a large membership, I suspect in the hundreds of thousands. And a large layer of the far left involved in it. And the question is, what will happen to this formation? And I think it's likely to evolve beyond reformism. You know, it's likely the situation we're in, where capitalism is in deep crisis, discredits reformism as a solution and renders it unviable. So many of these militants will start looking for something beyond reformism. And of course, many of those people from the far left are already looking at things beyond reformism to a degree, you know. So you're likely to get a melange of different politics. And I mean, Zara Sultana gave a very militant speech on Thursday, and there's been a lot of pressure on them to actually get together and speak, appear in public together and get the party back on the road, etc., etc., etc. On Thursday, they did it. Unfortunately, the live stream seems to have been sabotaged, which I suspect foul play over that from some enemy force or something, but it was sabotaged. But I've seen the recordings of the speeches, and Zara Sultana's speech went through a whole load of things about class politics, the need to fight fascism in the streets, the need to oppose NATO, root and branch, the need to be anti-Zionist, and a whole lot more, really. You should watch it. It's a quasi-revolutionary speech, almost. Mm. Yeah, it didn't quite dot all the I's and cross all the T's. But probably the most left-wing speech I've seen from an ex-Labour MP ever. I mean, Chris Williamson is someone else who tends to go a bit beyond Labourism in some of the things he says. Well, she was going beyond that, you know, albeit purely rhetorically, you know. And this is before the party has even got off the ground, you know. I mean, I don't know exactly what her project is, but it seems to build a very militant organisation indeed. Whether it intends to be revolutionary is probably not the case, but she's certainly flirting with the idea of revolutionary politics, and you will see, you know, because of that is not unnatural, because we are in such a deep crisis. The neoliberalism is in deep crisis. You see US hegemony under threat. You see people talking about World War III being on the agenda fairly immediately. Whether that's true or not is beside the point. The point is, we are the large scale rise of the far right requires militant strategies and tactics to actually mobilise the working class to combat it, you know. And people are looking at that. They're looking at solutions, and I think she's one of them. And you're going to find others who have the same attitude and the same openness to other solutions. And therefore, an understanding that there is such a thing as centrism. And centrism is not bureaucratism. Centrism is not the politics of the Labour bureaucracy. Centrism is that politics that goes beyond reformism but doesn't consistently embrace a revolutionary programme and outlook. And there are examples in history. Karl Kautsky was a centrist during the First World War, and Lenin was very sharp against him. But he did actually oppose the war in a pacifist manner, you know. But Lenin was very sharp against him for giving a left cover to the Social Democrats, who were actually supporting the war and calling for unity and patching together the international that had collapsed, you know, instead of building a new international. That's an example of centrism, you know. The Independent Labour Party, which split from Labour in 1931 in the depths of the Great Depression, in the worst period of the Great Depression, the ILP, which is one of the founding components of the Labour Party, split to the left from Labour, and it started to organise something called the London Bureau of Revolutionary Socialist Parties, with other parties in Europe, including the Dutch Party, and I can't remember what. I think the PUM in Spain was associated with it as well. You know, all these parties that were sort of, that they had broken partly from social democracy, from reformism, but they hesitated and they didn't go as far as to embrace communism in a consistent manner, you know. And that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about bureaucratism and the flaws of bureaucratism in a party, which we all know there are flaws of bureaucratism in your party, and that's got to be fought as well, you know. But what we've got to fight against, what we've got to address, is the possibility of things arising that may actually talk very, very left indeed, and have to be dealt with politically in their own terms. And that is what we're talking about with centrism. I'll leave it there for now because I don't want to preempt the whole discussion. Thank you.
Well, it's
Marie, yeah?
Hello. Yes. Right. So it seems that since we are in a process where social democracy is being demolished, not just in Britain, but internationally in the workers' movement. Social democracy is being cast aside, but there is no example in the world of a country which you can say to everybody, look what socialism is like, this is where we want to go. So there is a slowness which comes from the fact that there is no clear guidance coming from examples in the world. There is nothing pure that you can say, look, this is the aim where we are going. At the same time, the fact that this is a process that proceeds from social democracy onwards. Well, I agree with what all your remarks about centrism, Ian. It's very easy to get this confused because it's not always clear. So we go from social democracy, and the Labour Party went through several abortions in that respect of people who were really trying to get over to another. Yeah, more socialized, more socialist vision. But that came in a process against social democracy. So in this country, social democracy is the mass party, was the mass party. And the mass party is mass party because it's based on the trade unions. And even though I accept what Ian says, that you know, the role of the trade unions has changed that nowadays, I still think that they are key on the political plane, not on the plane of how many they are, but on the plane of, for example, Palestine. So about Palestine, it is the mass of the working class, the youth, and the people who live from their labor who have understood that imperialism wants genocide in order to preserve its prerogatives and its predatory system. So, well, I think that we cannot just make such a leap from such a historic root, which is social democracy, towards a new form which might not be revolutionary, but which might tend to become revolutionary or might be forced to become revolutionary, because capitalism is now preparing conscription and you will have to say no. Or the fascists take direct action and one has to actually go and do something. So there is a process which is forcing the revolutionary perspective to become clearer and clearer. And in this, it seems to me one cannot forget that it is the fire which is under the cauldron is the working class. And not just in Britain, the working class in every huge capitalist country, the working class is playing a major role. For example, in the United States, Vietnam, it was, wasn't Vietnam that won the war. It was Vietnam thanks to the masses and workers of the United States. And this is repeated in many ways in other struggles, even though the Palestinians are, at the moment, are not in the best place. And I cannot really explain too much about the working class of the Arab countries. But nevertheless, those working classes, they are our allies. And I do not think that such a transformation is going to take place in Britain without being part of something happening at the level of Ukraine or the level of Palestine, where the working class has its say. Like there was this general strike in Italy, though one should not overestimate it. It was a political general strike in support of Palestine. And this happens a lot in France as well. The CGT is very prominent in all the Palestinian demonstrations. We don't have that here. And I think this should not be forgotten, because in the process where we are leaving off social democracy and entering a stage which tends to need revolutionary solutions, but then there is cannot be divorced. For example, the new party, the radicalism which is appearing there is based on Palestine, is based on the fight of humanity, which is the fight of the world. And so, I will come back later for more, but I think this, what you are describing, it is not by chance that it is happening in the orbit of labor, and there is a crisis in the representation of the working class, and this is linked. This is linked. The working class needs to represent itself, and it's not going to take place through the organization of another social democratic party, but through a leap which is going to demand Soviets, for example, or direct intervention of people in the streets, like I think some of you have said. Yeah, so I'll come back later to see if that can be looked at again. Thank you.
Anybody else?
I'm just taking a minute to put my hand up. Okay. I think for me, the real problem with centrism is that it promises compromise and pragmatism. But in actual fact, what it always fails to do is to address injustice. Yes, you can't say we are going to, we are going to solve the injustices of a situation by saying, well, we'll meet you halfway. You have to address injustice by undoing what has been done that is unjust. You know, if you look at Vietnam, the tragedy isn't that, you know, oh, poor America, they lost the war in Vietnam. The tragedy is the collateral damage that was done to Cambodia. It is the injustice that has been done to the people of Vietnam, and the fact that America is such a miserable, rotten loser that it continues to sanction, to punish the people for the crime of, you know, of winning the war, because it was an unjust war in the first place. So, you know, in the examples of what is wrong with what's happening in Gaza, nothing that is in the situation that is happening is going to undo the injustice that was done from 1948. There is no suggestion in any way, shape or form that they will bring, you know, that the real solution to what has happened is not, is to remove the state of Israel, which has shown itself to be completely inadequate to be, as you know, a state, in the same way that white South Africa was completely inadequate as a state to address the needs of the people. It has to end. And the truth is, this is centrism in work. It's always about compromise. You compromise with injustice by just entrenching the injustice, which is what I think you were talking about. You know, if we're looking at the working classes, the point is the establishment, you know, they own 90%, you know, 99% of the wealth. They control 90% of everything that happens. And, you know, if we come to halfway, what will we get? We will get, you know, if we're lucky, we might get 15% or 10% instead of 1%. But what we will not do is get the majority that the working classes should get. You know, they are creating a future in which, as far as I can see, systematically, they are going to just simply remove the working class while turning the working class into the undermensch, the non-working class, that they can then decide who is the deserving poor that will get charity, i.e. universal income or whatever, and who are the undeserving poor who will get nothing but will be told, you know, but will be told to be happy about it. You know, centrism is a real danger to the left more than the right, because centrism offers compromise and keeping the status quo. And if the status quo is unjust, then it cannot reform itself.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can I come back on
apologies,
this?
Apologies, Ian.
Yeah, can I come back on this? And I think we're talking at cross
purposes. Please do.
I think we're talking at cross purposes, and I think we're not even got an agreed definition of what centrism is. You know, as I said, centrism, I think we need to do some reading on this. That was a mistake to not circulate the readings and actually have a proper presentation on it. With based on some text or something, as we did with the Revolution Betrayed. You know, I think we need to get our head round this question, because it's, you know, we are not talking about centrism in the sense of Tony Blair. We are not talking about centrism in the sense of the politics of the Labour so-called centre. You know, that's not what we're talking about. I'm trying to project something that we haven't seen, except on among small Trotskyist groups, for a very long time, which is a, you know, which is a phenomena in the working class movement, which goes beyond parliamentary reformism in a mass sense. We have seen such things, but not recently, you know. Not in the Western countries, but we are likely to see them. And that's what I was trying to get across to people. But I think it's not really, you know, come across coherently as yet. And I think we need to get some texts distributed for people to read and some definitions as to what we're dealing with. Because I think it is a crucial aspect of what your party may well become. It may well become something much more left-wing than people think it may become, you know. It may become something that really... and if you... I don't know if anybody has watched Zara Sultana's speech on Thursday in Liverpool.
Yeah.
But that was a quasi-revolutionary speech. It mentioned so many things that are quite pretty close to revolutionary Marxism, actually, you know. Now, why is an ex-Labour MP... who's really recently left the Labour Party, giving such a left-wing speech? And I think it's because there is an objective situation that parliamentary reformism is no longer a viable strategy. And some people, including her, are beginning to suspect that that is that they've got to go further, you know. And basically, this is a symptom of this. And we need to examine the possibilities of what may happen, you know. And the dangers of centrism is that centrism in a revolutionary situation will make a lot of left-wing phrases, a lot of revolutionary rhetoric comes to the fore in a revolutionary situation. And there could be a revolutionary situation emerging in the next period. It's entirely possible. If such a thing happens and such a party emerges, we have a problem because you know, if a party in a revolutionary situation appears to be ahead of the mass and the working class, but then capitulates in some way, it can lead to a total disaster, you know. And the Spanish Civil War is an example where the PUB, which is the party of the left. Left to the left of the social democracy, to the left of Stalinism, right? Actually, when the push came to shove, it joined the Popular Front, you know, which was the political formation that that basically squashed the revolution, you know. Even though it had the best of intentions, it capitulated on that question. But its rhetoric, its whole, you know. You know, if you watch Ken Loach's film Land of Freedom, it shows the ferment in the peasantry, in the working class, in the Spanish Revolution, and the attempts of the Stalinists, etc., to suppress that. And it shows, I think, there's a particular incident of a shooting where they went in and they shot down some leaders of a peasant commune or something. I can't remember the full details, you know. But it shows the consequences in a revolution of having a leadership that talks very left wing, but does, but when it comes to it, it does as it's told by the ruling class, you know. Whereas in the Russian Revolution, you had a party that pushed it all the way to the revolution, you know. Whereas people like Stalin wanted to give support to provisional government, you know. Stalin, Zinoviev and Kamenev wanted to give support to the provisional government, and they were overruled by Lenin, who basically said, no, we no support to the provisional government. We steer towards a government of the Soviets, you know. That was an example of centrism in a revolutionary party, that even the revolutionary party could generate a centrist wing that is prepared to... That doesn't have the political vision and the political courage to push the revolution to its logical conclusion, and instead will seek a solution that's a halfway house, which again leads to a compromise and the likely defeat of the revolution. That's what was that's what would have happened in Petrograd in 1917 if Lenin had not returned, you know. Because Trotsky, although he had the same position, he did not have the authority in the party that Lenin had, because Lenin was the recognised leader of the party, you know. So if Stalin, Zinoviev and Kamenev had actually been able to implement their position, again, Lenin was not there to contradict them and to put a correct position and to steer the course towards all power to the Soviets, as opposed to, you know, pressuring the provisional governments, there would not have been an October Revolution, you know. And that's what I'm trying to get over, really, in this discussion. I think it's become somewhat confused, and I think we need to have a proper educational of it, maybe in a couple of weeks' time or something, on centrism and the Russian Revolution, and explaining what that means, you know, concretely. I'll have a look for some writing on this, maybe not 2 weeks' time, maybe 4 weeks' time, or sometime soon anyway, you know. We should have an educational on this, a proper one, where we can thrash it all out and actually understand the question, because I think at the moment it's become somewhat confused, you know. Anyway, I know Paul wants to speak, so I'll let him speak. Cheers. Paul?
Only to say that I haven't seen Donald Trump on his speech yet, but if it's as radical as you suggest, then maybe, perhaps there might be a thinking, at least privately, from some of the MPs, that perhaps, due to the way the government has been heading, there could be a concern about barriers, more barriers being put in place to stop certain candidates from standing at the next election. Maybe that's another kind of thing going on. So that would also suggest that an extra pardon, you know, a route outside Parliament is needed beyond what we're currently used to. That would give the thought that that cropped into my head, because the way people are being arrested at the moment for simply holding up a sign, it does suggest that we're sort of becoming a bit a dictatorship in a very quick kind of way. But more and more dictatorial legislation or draconian legislation keeps coming our way, and maybe there are concerns about current serving MPs. Maybe there is a thinking that, you know, whether it might be the level of deposit they have to pay, or certain candidates with a certain party name can't stand. It's not beyond the bounds of possibility at this point. The quote, as far as I'm concerned. I'll stop there. I'm rambling now.
Paul, Marie, you wanted to speak.
So it seems to me Suzanne was making a point about injustice. She took that as an example, and she said, you can't say to it, you're meeting it halfway, because that would just simply won't work. If the aim is to resolve it, then you can't meet it halfway. It seems to me that that was somewhere taking us forward in the sense of showing that there is objectively no centre, no centrism viable when you are trying to actually achieve something properly. And it seems to me in the process where we have your party or a party like it, they are going to have to deal with this, well, what I understand about this, in the sense that they will have people inside their own ranks who are going to start making conciliation with the old social democracy, and probably they will go to that party precisely to try to hold it back. And then there will be that necessity which is pushing forward all the time. So now I take it that centrism is not in social democracy. It is between the classes. And so if you are taking a position which is favorable to the working class, then you are leaving the position of opportunism, of advancing oneself. I don't know if that helps. By necessity, the problem is such now with Palestine, with Ukraine, and with the war preparations, is it going to be impossible for a centrist policy to develop for long in that new party if it is going to continue to exist? Because very rapidly, the capitalist class is putting all the money into armaments and into the reorganization of the economy, which includes the society as well, the schools, the universities, they're attacking everything in order to prepare for war. And so the party is going to have to say the reason why there is no money for the masses, why there is austerity and really great necessity developing in the country with even pupils who are not eating properly in schools. The party is going to have to raise, where is the money going to? And the money is going to war preparation. And so it seems to me that before one discusses the form and the constitution of the party, one should discuss what is necessary to achieve. And what's necessary to achieve is to oppose the resources of the country going for war preparations in order to perpetuate the interests of the capitalists. And perhaps this should be the center of the debate at the top over there, where they are creating the party, instead of who is doing what and which organization is joining in. Organizations will join according to the aim that is proposed. And so the important, it seems to me, is the aim. Yeah. Finish.
Paul.
A question for Murray, really. I think you said earlier that social democracy is basically dead. But isn't that, again, this is another issue I have, because there are some people in your party that suggest that maybe some sort of alliance could be formed with Jack Palanki and the Greens. Now, if you take that one step further, by which you can take that my personal view of Jack Palanki is he gives an opportunity. He's not a radical person at all. He's a standard bourgeois politician. And I don't think in the long run we're going to see many changes in Green Party politics in England and Wales. And when you say social democracy is dead, which I don't disagree with, by the way, but let's suppose Jack Palanki and the Green Party start gaining a bit of traction. Don't you think there is a danger that Jack Palanki and the Green Party may well revive social democracy? That's my question.
Am I expected to say something?
Yeah, do you want me to repeat my question?
No. I will not be long because I do not dominate the subject and I will count on others to answer that properly. But the way I see it is social democracy is not dead. It's just sinking into, well, if it's going into fascism or it's letting itself be taken over. And so by capitalism and by the right wing and by NATO and by the war. And so it's not dead. It's a process. And in that process, it is then that contradictions appear, which are allowing us to put forward a new vision. And about the Green Party, I don't see this as if the new party is saying something correct, according to me, it will attract people of the Green Party or even the Green Party itself, I don't know, and then there would be a further process of clarification amongst all the newcomers. But we're discussing centrism here, and I don't see the Greens are centrists, according to what we're discussing. It seems to me they are simply a bourgeois party, quite honestly, which has a vision which capitalism cannot give any answer to, but they themselves do not propose the program and the policy to actually defend the environment and defend the planet. And so on. They don't have the conception of the change in society which is required to get this done. Yeah, that's it.
Anybody else want to speak on any of this?
Well, I do agree with Marie. My concerns about the Greens, where they are, is that, as you say, you can talk about social justice, you can talk about democracy, you can talk about ecological protection, but unless you have concrete policies that will address both the reasons for their endangerment and the acceptance of the solutions that will protect them, yes? It's a bad example, but what I'm going to say is, you know, which side are you stand on the Ukraine war depends upon whether or not you think that the injustice was the Maidan coup and the CIA taking over of a regime where they then put in a Nazi regime, which is intended on genociding or completely eradicating, you know, a third of the population, Crimea and the Donbass, and those of the ethnic Russian element that they wish to either displace or remove or brainwash out of their Russian culture. If you regard it as thou shalt not invade a sovereign country, then you can support the new government, no matter where it was originated from, no matter when it, or you know, when it started. You can just go, oh, it's got to go back to the 1991 boundaries, because there has to be restoration of what was there originally, without any concern about what happened in between. And what happened, what's going wrong? This is why I say centrism, with its constant efforts at compromise and pragmatism, just simply falls. And you cannot get get people who look at it and go, Russia went in to protect the people who were being killed and who would have been genocided. They went in to protect the environment, which was being systematically degraded to the point where people would not have been able to live in Crimea and the Donbass because their water was being cut off for a decade. And it was done deliberately because it was, you will leave the land and the resources we want, or you will die. And we, you know, and it's the same in Gaza. We don't look at it and say we have to invade Gaza in order to protect the people who are living there. We just stand back, and centrism says we must have a compromise. We must persuade Israel to stop genociding the population because we have to have a compromise. But you cannot compromise with injustice and supremacism and, you know, settler colonialism just simply creates an injustice that social democracy cannot address without war. So we may want peace, but we have to be prepared to back it up. So, yeah, I'm going to oppose the Greens for the same reason that I will oppose centrism. I don't think it never, ever comes up with solutions. It only comes up with complaints about the status quo without actually admitting that it is the status quo that has created those problems. Yeah. So I'm sorry if it's not the support you were expecting, but I do agree with what you were saying, Marie. Yeah. Go on, Ian.
You're muted.
Hang on, I'm not muted now. Get a little thing that says I'm muted. Yeah, I agree with quite a lot of what Susan said, actually, and that does actually impinge on the questions of centrism. Because centrism is, you know, I mean, obviously a position of defending Ukraine and of supporting the victory of... defending not Ukraine, but the Donbass people in Ukraine against the Ukrainian far-right regime, against the Maidan regime, is a core revolutionary position, which I think we stand on. And those who flinch from that, I think justly can be called centrist. You know, that's one important aspect of this. And I think that's where we are going to have a fight with probably even with Zara Sultana, possibly, you know. On the other hand, it's not out of the question that we can win people over to that, because we've already seen Chris Williamson go over to that position, to a position of defence of the Donbass, you know. But it's a position that if we advocate this in your party, it will polarise things. And the Sparks have actually distributed a proposal for a draft revolutionary, what do you call it, a platform of a revolutionary caucus. And it's got several things in it. And one of the things that's not in it, which is their position, is defence of China against imperialism. And it does mention Ukraine, but it doesn't really take a position on it. Now, one thing I want to amend in it is to put something... I'll be very brief about China. And just to make it very clear what position we're advocating on Ukraine, which is not their position, because they're actually a neutral. They're neutral, and we're not. But there are other things on trans rights where they're a bit wonky, and their stuff on immigration, I think, makes concessions They're not really very clear what they're saying, but it does actually, in my opinion, rhetorically make concessions to anti-migrant chauvinism to a degree, you know. So I'd like to amend some of these things as well. But they are looking for amendments to their proposals, and I think it's an opportunity to have a go at them in a few ways, and to also to try and draw them into some sort of block, and to have a debate with them on some of these questions, and to have a debate with others as well, because I think they are approaching various groups who are now involved in your party, like the Weekly Worker, like the I don't know who else, actually, because I'm not sure who else would even consider, you know, such a block of ostensibly Marxist organisations. There aren't too many groups around who might consider it at the moment, because the larger groups are too contemptuous of any of the more serious smaller groups, that I don't see any of them being interested, you know. But on the other hand, in the environment of a party, which if you cut your party becomes a real party with a real party ethos, this stuff can become subsumed in the internal life of the party. And instead of having sect competitions, you start to get real debates about policy that cross sectarian lines. And I think that's something that may well be also part of the healthy development of your party if it goes that way, you know. So I think there are all sorts of possibilities. But yes, I think Susan is right in the sense that what she said about Ukraine and those who flinch from a hard position in defence of the Donbass people and in defence of Russia are behaving as centrists. She's quite right, you know. Paul?
In one of your earlier replies to my talk, you mentioned about the SWP possibly joining your party, but as events unfolded, I don't think they will do, because their position has somewhat been exposed by someone in Lambeth, I know, had inadvertently leaked their instructions that they'd had from the SWP Central Committee, which boils down to effectively try and run as many of your party meetings as you can, and if you can't run them, they've effectively been told to basically cause as many problems as they can. So I don't think the SWP will join. I think they might post in their WhatsApp groups in order to get people to support their Stand Up to Racism events, which is another front for the SWP. But I don't think they will formally join your party. I think they disguise themselves as a revolutionary party, but really they're petit bourgeois, in my opinion. I'm interested in the fact that the Sparks appear to have joined your party because some of the things I agree on, because you remember Ian and I went to a meeting with the, as two colleagues of Consistent Democrats, and we had a very good meeting with them. But I can confirm that the position on Ukraine, unfortunately, was pretty shoddy. It wasn't based on the material reality of it. It was based on an aspiration of what one might want to see, but it had no bearing on what the forces on the ground at that particular time. Nevertheless, they do have some positions that I personally agree on. So I think that is going to have to be a fight that's going to have to be had in the your party. I really do hope that they don't stop March of groups actually getting involved. Because I think as long as people are open about what March of group they belong to, whether it's the Op correspondent, Consistent Democrats, whatever, as long as people are honest about that, they should be allowed to publish their material. And where it becomes contentious is, I suppose, is if people try to put forward candidates against your party. But I think that's unlikely to happen. I am a bit worried that although I'm still not involved with your party, I'm I'm sort of involved with it on the outskirts, like, but I'm not actually a formal member. But I am concerned, partly because I am somewhat concerned that the radicalism that appears so far may well be sort of pushed out. Or it could be that people like those in China effectively become frightened of their own success in some ways. Maybe that's what happened with some of the organisations that Crocky was talking about, and then it became, then they became centrist in a Crockyist sense of the word, didn't they? Which I think, but I couldn't think of a way to sort of link it to your party, so it's a bit muddled because, as Ian says, your party isn't a centrist organisation because it was never revolutionary in the first place. I think that was what Ian point was from when he and I had private discussions over it. So that's where I got somewhat confused because, I stopped there. Thanks.
Who else wants to speak? Well, can I just make a couple of... Oh, so Marie, you want to speak? No?
No, I wanted to ask a question, but perhaps not the best. I see the Westphalian position that Susan is talking about. Sorry, this is perhaps not the centre of the subject. Oh. But I looked it up and I saw somewhere on Google it says each state is finds itself exclusively sovereign over its territory. And I think that the MAGA policy of the United States is putting that to bed.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's why I'd written in the chat to... Oh, sorry. To say... Oh, apologies, Ian, for interrupting. Yeah,
that's all right.
That it... The point is China has maintained or had maintained its position that countries should respect one another's borders because it is, you know, it is part of the, you know, ongoing last 100 years or certainly last 75 years that the attempts of America in particular, but the West specifically, to break up Russia and China as land masses, to try and introduce ethno-fascism as a way of destroying the tolerance and the unification, the federal system that both Russia and China espouse as their way of keeping things together, that this is what's being continually attacked by the fact that the West and the UN recognize these so-called independents, whether it's Kosovo, whether it's Taiwan, it's that constant, you can be independent because it suits us politically to make economic and political war on you, but we will not recognize other countries' attempts to become independent. Obviously, Crimea and the Donbass is one example, but there have been plenty of others where... You know, with Serbia, they have not recognized it. They've simply gone in all guns blazing. It's the same with, you know, their response to Iran is we will balkanize that. We will break it up. And we will, and they've already done it to Syria, to Libya. You know, that they are destroying countries by persuading them. They're trying, you know, it wasn't just Taiwan. It was also the Uyghurs. It's persuading people that they are victims and then persuading them to demand it. And China's reaction has been to recognize the Westphalian position of countries should recognize other countries, you know, other people's borders. But if a group of people want genuine independence, it has to be by agreement of some sort. But if a country is obliterating that request or that expectation of independence, then sooner or later, either those people or that or their neighbours are the ones who are going to have to go in and stop that. Yeah? You know, Rwanda would be another case in point. We, you know, countries should not want genocide on their borders because it creates refugees and immigration, you know, immigrants and people who then destabilize their own countries. Yeah. This is what I was talking about, injustice. Centrism has no response to dealing with that. Anyway, apologies if I've gone on too long, Marie.
Ian, can I ask another question?
Yes, of course.
Yes. Sorry, Ian, I'll try not to take you too far from the subject. So, in my view, China and Russia and Vietnam and North Korea, they need to unite. Hold on, let me finish here. they need to unite and in the end to have the perspective of the elimination of boundaries. And so I would like to ask Ian what he thinks in view of the necessity, the socialist necessity of the Socialist Federation of Workers' States, would the position which Suzanne defines as Westphalian in China. Well, do you consider that centrist?
Well, no, I don't think it's anything to do with this discussion in a way, but it overlaps with it in a funny way. Because Susan has been criticising, rightly, those on the left who flinch from defending the Donbass and the rights of the people of Donbass. And she's quite right. And that is a symptom of centrism. You know, I think the Spartacists are centrist because they take a position on the Ukraine. It's a very left-sounding position, but it doesn't hard take a side on that question where there is a question of national oppression. That's very clear on the side of the people of the Donbass and Crimea and probably Odessa and the whole region around that as well. You know, those people are being oppressed by a Nazi, extreme Ukrainian nationalist state that's being funded by NATO. And the Russian army is stopping that. And I think those who flinch from defending the special military operation are behaving, in a sense, as centrists, particularly those who claim to be revolutionaries, like the Spartacist League or even the Communist Party of Great Britain, the Weekly Worker, that is, and others. And there are other people who are hardened Stalinists who've got the right position, which, more or less, like the CPGBML, the other CPGB, they're correct on that question, you know, to back the people of the Donbass. So we have something in common with them, as opposed to the Sparts and the Weekly Worker, who are softer on that question. But sometimes you can be right for the wrong reasons. And that's you have to look at the totality of people's politics. And I think the reason that the CPGBML refused to, even though we signed up their document, they refused to publish the fact that we signed it, is because of their visceral anti-Trotskyism, you know. Which is wrong politically, you know. They are hardened Stalinists, and even you know, in terms of their heritage and their understanding of politics, it's not necessarily everything they say today is consistent with that. But that is their understanding of their tradition, and they are, Trotsky is horrible, you know, sort of thing. You know, that's their attitude. You know. So it's complicated, you know. We do want to interact with all these people. We've got the same position, more or less, on the Donbass as the CPGBML. But they won't have anything to do with us because of our positions on other things, you know. Whereas we've got more in common with the Sparts and perhaps the CPGB, although they're a bit different, on many things, you know. Let me just shut this door. There's a lot of noise. Hang on a second. I'll carry on. So it's a bit complicated, you know. The politics of the left is very complicated. It might get more complicated if we get the emergence of a centrist wing of social democracy through your party, perhaps around Zara Sultana. That will make life even more complicated. There'll be a lot of things to sort out, you know. But who knows? I mean, just on some questions. The Treaty of Westphalia was signed in 1648, so it goes back a long way. It's concurrent with the English Civil War. I think it's something to do with the 30 Years' War that went on more or less at the same time. And it did actually put the nation-state into some sort of codified international legal framework for the first time, you know. So it is important. And there are people who reject that idea because it's very simplistic and it tends to be favouring ethnic states, you know, and to trample over the rights of ethnic minorities or national minorities in other states. And I think that's a correct attitude, you know, that we are for the rights of peoples, not the rights of states, you know. So we don't support Zelensky's right to retain Crimea and Donbass and wherever by force against the will of the population of those areas, because basically we are for the rights of peoples. And not some states are democratic, you know, some states have a democratic way of accommodating national differences, like Switzerland, for instance, or whatever, you know. But there are some cases, some states are very oppressive of national minorities, and I think that the problem is with Ukraine is it was cobbled together as part of a subunit of a multinational state, which was the USSR, and it was not viable as a separate state because it was unstable, you know, because it had a huge national minority of Russians in it that was fine as long as they were all united in a multinational state. But as soon as it came apart, it became highly problematic, and it was not democratic, you know, especially when they decided to make it a monolingual state, you know, which is what happened after 2014, you know. So it's, you know, it's not democratic, and the Treaty of Westphalia, people who adhere to that are arguing against democracy, effectively, and arguing against the rights of self-determination of real national groups, you know. What else is there to say about... there's a couple of questions. What is the Green Party? The Green Party is a petty bourgeois radical party. That's what its main focus of ideology and is obviously the environment. It's in its name, isn't it? You know, and the environment is a real problem. You know, it's something that we have to take up. And you know, I think there's something about the Sparks, this, you know, hostile attitude to the Green Party in total is. It's off beam, you know, it's wrongly emphasised. We are hostile to the Green Party because it's a petty bourgeois party, but we're not hostile to the environmental question. And we need to make that distinction very clear. We are in favour of it. The only way the environmental question can be addressed is by socialist economic planning on a global level in the end. And that's our question. It's not their question because they're petty bourgeois radicals who want to make use of the market and various other things, you know. So it's our question. We shouldn't just dismiss the Greens in a crude manner, you know. As to Vietnam and wherever, whether they should join with China in the Federation, maybe ideally they should. Whether they actually will or not is another question, because I think there's a lot of differences between them, between the various bureaucracies and and whatever. We could advocate a worldwide, well, you know, an international federation of remaining worker states. Yes, we could do that, but the chances of it being realised, short of a political revolution in all these countries, is quite slim, I would have thought, you know. But maybe later. That's all. Cheers. Susan?
I was going to put a question to Mark, if you don't mind, because my understanding, Mark, is you're much more au fait with the feelings within North Korea. But my understanding was that whereas for most of the last, since the split, North Korea and South Korea have both wanted to reunite, in the last couple of years, North Korea has basically said it no longer wishes to reunite, and they just fear being overwhelmed by South Korea, with the help of America wiping it out. So I was really going to ask you, is it true that North Korea now wishes to be a separate state?
Who's that question directed to?
I'm asking Mark, am I right in thinking that you...
Well, Susan,
you have contact.
I'm
no, Mark Copeland,
oh,
sorry.
Oh, God, yeah, I'm not open.
No, I apologize. I do apologise. I should have said Mark C. But am I right, or am I getting you confused with Dermot?
I think you probably get confused with Dermot.
Okay.
I hadn't heard North Korea.
No.
Dermot is a very good guy, but he's a hard Stalinist supporter of North Korea.
Okay. But am I not right in thinking, I'm hoping I haven't got it wrong, but my belief is that they, you know, destroyed the roads and the bridges because in the recent attempt at the coup in South Korea to turn it into a martial state, you know, to bring in martial law and to turn it into a on a war footing, They were concerned that they would be overrun in America's attempt to find more weapons and a, you know, they, because South Korea will be under, you know, American control should it turn into a war footing. And America is desperate for more proxy armies, whether it's Ukraine or, any, you know, Turkey or anyone else. And whether or not this is what has moved China from its position on protecting or, you know, supporting minorities like, or supporting the special military operation in particular.
I don't know the answer to that, to be honest.
Okay.
I mean, it's possible
the other thing
it might
that
be a consideration, yeah. But I don't really know.
The other thing is that basically China is taking the position that it will refuse to allow America the wherewithal to make the weapons because it is not going to allow America to continue to play, you know, the great game of chess as it is with so many countries and pawns of so many countries using war as a means to destroy other economies because in order to maintain its hegemony. Go on. Yeah.
I'm not sure. Yeah, on the relations between those countries. Yeah. I mean, I think that North Korea has never been in favour of unification with the South, except on its own terms. But that's not going to happen, is it? You know, and it doesn't have a revolution. I don't know what our position should be. We're for the revolutionary reunification of Korea, but the current Korean regime is not capable of doing that because it's basically, you know, it's a conservative, Stalinist regime. It's very content with what it's got. It would regard a revolution in the South Korea as being very threatening to it. It would destabilise their regime, and it would lay the basis for the emergence of working class democracy and Soviets and all the things that even though it's a Stalinist regime, it's been around for a very long time. It does have some progressive features, and we should defend it. It would regard that as threatening, but for the wrong reasons, because it wouldn't be threatening to the social foundations of the regime. The social foundations of the workers' state, it would be threatening to the political regime that runs it, because that's not revolutionary. But if you had a workers' revolution in South Korea, that is a long way away, I suspect. you know, it's not something that's easy to envisage at the moment. There's nothing to lead it, you know. But on the other hand, the mass sentiment does exist. That it's been shown to exist at times. There's been a sort of like an upsurge of sympathy for the North over some issues, you know. There are lots of students in South Korea who are very pro-North, you know. There have been all sorts of funny things have happened that sort of puncture the idea that there's a sympathy, a universal sympathy for the United States in North Korea, in South Korea. That's not really true, you know. So there is potential there, but I don't think the North is in a position or is really interested in harnessing it, because it poses the question of a wider social revolution. And that is, unfortunately, that's not what Stalinism is about. It doesn't like that, you know. It will kill people who get in the way, who do that, you know. I mean, historically it has done, you know. Stalinist regimes have assassinated would-be revolutionaries in the Spanish War, you know. Because they feared that a revolution that actually succeeded would eclipse their authority, and they would be, it would benefit Trotsky, you know, or something similar. I know Trotsky's dead, you know, but something similar, you know. And that would be their attitude today. But we still defend them against imperialism. We defend the social gains that exist. And if there's any threat to North Korea from, you know, from imperialism or from reactionary forces within, we're opposed to it. You know. John, you want to speak? Sorry.
Yeah. No, I don't, you know, it's very difficult to talk about the nature of the period you're living in, you know, and we can speculate and thing. But, you know, I mean, I'm not sure we are living in a position, in a period of social revolutions. I don't know. I mean, it depends what you talk about a period, but there, you know, there doesn't seem to be, you know, I mean, things, there are definite shifts that have taken place in the last few years, which indicate that the old ways are over. But, you know, in many respects, you know, like this thing that Starmer's become so unpopular so quickly, and that your party is growing, and that we have these big demonstrations with flags, and that, you know, obviously there's something going on, but what it is it's too early to say, you know, what the implications are. Like you're saying, South Korea, you know, is a long way. Yeah, it probably is a long way, you know, but still, you know, you know, capitalism, in, I mean, in a certain sense, it still has stability in it. I think more stability than you seem to think. I mean, there hasn't been a dollar crisis yet or anything like that. That may be around the corner, but, America's still calling the shots, you know, around the world, you know, and... okay, sorry. I mean, the fact that, you know, it's the fact that the working class are gonna, you know, that there's a revolutionary movement anywhere, it's just not the case at the moment. And that's why I find all this talk about centrism, although it's important, it's you know, we're not in that period where centrism will come to the fore in a big way. You know, it hasn't taken hold. I mean, where all this, you know, we'll see where the debate between Sultana and Corbyn goes, because that you know, that will be interesting. I mean, don't forget the Benite movement just, you know, went very quickly. I mean, it went, you know, it the debate's still to be had, and how much legs this thing has got on it, these various factions within the within your party, you know, how many, you know, how many, you know, whether this is just a blip and it will settle down again. I don't think it will settle down completely because things have definitely changed. But you know, there's going to become, we've got to be wary that things like the Benite movement did come and go quite quickly in a way, you know, that's why I ended up joining the SWP really at the time because the Benite movement did fail and the Labour right and that were able to reassert themselves on the Labour movement as a whole during the 80s, in that they think. Now what happens now with this new party and that is, I think this idea of a revolutionary caucus is very good, you know, it's the thing because I think it's important that that's fought for and because whatever comes out of the infighting within the thing that Marxists can get some sort of a foothold within the developments that take place is important, and I think that's the biggest thing that could come out of this.
Mark.
Yeah, I was just thinking, politicians always say that we live in dangerous times, don't they? But as far as I can remember, ever since I've been alive, it's been dangerous. So I can't see that it's any different. This Labour, Starmer, was unpopular from day one. A lot of the far right started out disliking him because they think he's on the left. The Labour Party are absolutely shocking, I agree, but we have to be careful we don't get mixed up with the far right, with stuff they're making up, which is kind of like they're talking about stuff that the last government, the last Tory party over the last 14 years did. There's no way this government could change that within a year, not that they're doing anything towards it anyway. The other point I was going to make is I think these so-called scraps in your party have just been heated discussions. And I think the media, especially Navarra, have made it sound worse than it actually is. And I think there's always going to be disagreements amongst the left. There's never disagreements amongst the far right. You won't have reform disagreements. They're too bleeding stupid. But the left are always going to disagree with each other. And I think it's been a bit of an overreaction. What will come of it is very difficult to say, and I think somebody said they might end up being a centrist party. Well, that might be so. Everybody seems to, in the end, they seem to swing towards the centre. But I don't know. There's too many people starting in this new party. The thing I don't like about the Green Party is the blokes like Elvis. He's kind of this great performer and everybody's following him and he's kind of all glittery and sounds fantastic and I just don't trust that. And it's great he makes some great arguments, but there's no depth to them at all. It's like kind of, I don't know, it's superficial. So I have to wait and see what happens with that because the rest of the party might rally together and do something. But all you're hearing about at the moment is Polanski. That's what I've got to say. Thank you.
Paul, and then me.
I have to say that caricature by Mark C of referring to Polanski like Elvis somewhat amuses me. Thanks for that, Mark.
Elvis, but you know what I mean. He's a performer. He's attracted a lot of
Seriously though, the point I want to make was Ian, we're just discussing about North Korea and South Korea. And you said that if South Korea were to sort of become revolutionary, in regime terms, I agree that would probably become a threat to the North Korean regime, wouldn't it? And it reminds me, perhaps you might think I'm a bit far off on this one, but it reminds me of what appeared to have happened during the Spanish Civil War with the Puma. Because when they were making some, it seemed they were making some headway, because I watched Ken Loach's Land and Freedom, which you agreed was a fairly accurate portrayal of what took place. And eventually, sadly, toward the end of the film, Stalinists came in and shot them all, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I shot there.
Can I just say that, regards to what Mark Copestate just said, do you think it underlies that we haven't really got our message through as to what centrism is? Because I'm using centrism in a completely different manner, with a completely different definition to the way it's conventionally used today. And that's been used since the day of Tony Blair, right? Whereas the definition I'm using has been in current since the days of Lenin, you know. But the problem is that this term in everyday English has been replaced. And there is no other real term for it either way. I mean, there is in terms of Blairism. I just call it Blairism. You know, it's or neoliberal social democracy or whatever. But what I'm talking about is politics that's to the left of mainstream social democracy, but to the right of outright communism. And there's a spectrum of politics between old Labour and the communists, you know, which was, this is why I think we need another. I need to do a proper presentation on this, on what it is, because it sounds like it's some sort of abstruse theoretical subject, but it's not, because your party is a split to the left from the Labour Party, and it's got a mass base, or at least the beginnings of one, right? And what can happen to it is quite complex. And you could see, and I think in terms of Zara's speech the other day, it's quite likely you will see forms of politics that are almost revolutionary, that use revolutionary rhetoric, which confront the capitalist system with the possibility of revolution, but don't have a consistently revolutionary programme. That's the problem that I'm trying to get across. But the problem is there is a confusion of language, because the term centrist in the last few decades, since Tony Blair's day, has come to mean people like Tony Blair. And that's not what I'm talking about, right? That's not what the subject of this educational is. Right, and I think there's been a lot of confusion about this, which is understandable, because the whole language has changed. But it's going to have to change back if we're going to deal with the, or at least we're going to have to address this question again, if this becomes a real issue. And I think it probably will. You know, we've had to deal with centrism on the left, on the Trotskyist left, because you've had various Trotskyist organisations that have in reality been semi-reformist, you know, or flip-flopped around like nobody's business over the last, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. You've had this problem of the fragmentation of the Trotskyist movement and the disappearance of a coherent movement, and you've had all kinds of organisations with different kinds of politics that all claim to be Trotskyist, and are all over. You know, what did Trotsky say about centrism? There's one thing he said about it is that it scintillates with all the colours of the rainbow, right? And that's what he was talking about when he wrote these documents in 1934 and 1936 or whatever, the ones that Paul was looking at earlier on. But we need to use those documents and actually have some readings on them for people to look at. They're not very long, actually, some of these essays. But we need to have educationals on them so people understand what we're talking about, which is politics to the left of social democracy, not right-wing you know, social liberalism like Tony Blair, but politics to the left of reformism that are not quite, that are that nevertheless shy away from is the full embrace of revolutionary programs and communism, you know. With your party, this becomes a real possibility, and that's what I'm warning about. That's why we discuss. That's why I've sort of pushed to discuss this. But I think we need some readings to explain the subject in full, and maybe in a month's time we'll do something like that. Oh. If that's all right, Mark.
Yes. Yeah, so you want us to recognise centrism from a leftist perspective?
Yeah, that's the idea.
This isn't. Trust me, I'm not being sarcastic. I'm serious. You want us to recognise it before it could actually happen in your party.
Well,
so we know how to recognise. Yeah, we know how to recognise the signs. What against it?
Exactly. That's the point.
Would you say?
Yeah.
Can I just add one thing on that?
Yeah, sure.
Would you say you heard all of Zara's speech? I only heard a little bit of it. I know what you're saying. Would you say there is therefore an ideological schism between Zara's position on subjects and Corbyn's, which might have surprised you?
Definitely, yes.
And could you give an example?
Well, I mean, Zionism is one example, right? This whole thing about class politics and the need to fight the fascists in the streets, which she actually said explicitly in her speech, that's another example. He's never said anything like that, you know. There's a whole lot. You really need to listen to the whole speech.
Yeah.
It sounds like almost like a revolutionary speech, and it's obviously a sign of a serious ideological difference. And leftward movement for her own reasons, whether they're bureaucratic reasons or whether they're sincere, I suspect they're probably quite a lot of it is sincere, but there's also pressure on her from the Palestine movement, from others, to move to the left anyway because of the situation. But I suspect a lot of it is genuine. You know, this is what she thinks, you know. And she has moved to the left. She's been consistently to the left of Corbyn. And I was making this point about the Sparts in their public meeting yesterday. Is that they came out and said, oh, this whole thing is a shit show. And they put this leaflet out. I criticised them. The CPGB said the same thing. Well, the CPGB are not saying that now because they are applauding Zara Sultana's speech. Tina Becker put a thing on Facebook that she quoted big chunks of Zara Sultana's speech and said how wonderful it was. And it was a very good speech about it. So, blimey, this is not a shit show, is it? This is something quite startling. And the Sparts are more cynical about it. They say, the whole thing was a shit show, but now she's posturing and she's putting on a big show to sort of win over a particular base, and she's ticking on a checklist of things to say, sort of thing, that will inspire support from the far left, you know. Well, maybe she is, maybe she isn't. Maybe she's, you know, maybe she has some of these conceptions. Maybe she's not a cynic, you know. I don't think she's a cynic. I don't get the impression she's a cynic at all. You know, I think she's a young radical who's come out of the Labour Party in disgust at what's going on. And she is very young, and she's not some sort of old, farty cynic and you could just put on a show like, you know, some of these trade union bureaucrats who talk left. I don't think she's like that. I think there's a genuine leftist impulse in this. But I might be wrong. I might be just naive, you know.
No, you're naive. You're not naive.
But that's my take on all this anyway. Yeah.
I mean, there's been something bugging me about Corbyn being overall leader, apparently out of nowhere, and that would be that Zara Sultana could then be seen as a problem within the leadership of the party if she's not overall leader.
But it's supposed to be temporary, isn't it, until the conference? But yeah.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes, but it is a concern.
Susan.
Okay, I posted Zara's speech and Jeremy Corbyn's speech, and what I was going to suggest is maybe we should play the speeches. If we want to analyse where your party could go right or could go wrong, or if you like, could go right or could go left, centrist, whatever, is, yeah, use the readings that you've got from Trotsky and others about centrism to inform. But take something contemporary, i.e. the two speeches, and analyse them and look at where they go and how they fit into the left perspective that we are searching for. Because what we want to do is address what is now and what could be for the future. And yes, you know, you put your finger on it, words change. What centrism was 100 years ago, or 90 years ago with Trotsky, is not what centrism is now. You know, Oscar Wilde put his finger on it when he said, you know, English is the common language between America and Britain, America and England, yeah, divided by the Atlantic. It is two different countries which are using the same language but in completely different ways. And we have to move on by looking at contemporary examples, but then putting them back into their perspective as to which ones will lead to a real revolution and which ones are just going to lead to the same old status quo, which will always stumble the minute that they come to a, you know, a block in the road, in the same way that all of too many of the groups have said, oh, Russia's invading Ukraine, instead of looking at, well, America invaded Ukraine first. Yeah. We're cutting across to look at the injustice. Yeah. We're cutting across to look at where is the social justice that, you know, I hope we support. Yeah. We support equality, fairness, inclusion, and justice, social justice. And social justice for the workers won't come out of the current AI push for more and more ethno-fascist parties and states, will it?
No. Paul?
No.
Two things. One, to reply to the last point. Yes, word change, but they cannot change back again. So if there is a revolutionary situation that Ian referred to, and it does, and your party does become a revolutionary party, then centrism, in the sense that Croxley meant, it would actually become relevant again. So work can also change back as well. So I think I'm starting to understand a bit more now about what Ian's been kind of hit home about what centrism is, although it wasn't meant to be my talk. But yeah, but my understanding, my understanding is that in order to become centrist in the way that Croxley meant it, you have to be revolutionary to start with. It's only along the way you start to lose the radical work for whatever reason. Maybe you get frightened of what might happen if you carry through with it, or whatever it might be. Mark A actually encapsulated why I'm reluctant to join your party at the moment. I do actually think, this is somewhat ironic, because I always used to have it go in for attacking Jeremy Corbyn. However, as your party actually started to get underway, I'm afraid I do see Corbyn, I never like using the phrase about Corbyn, but there is still a whole bunch of people around Corbyn who have sort of latched onto his word without acknowledging where he has failed when he was Labour leader. And there is, yeah, you might have got maybe Mark Snyder and a few others have disappeared, at least temporarily. But nevertheless, there will still be people in Iran Corbyn's team that demonstrate that he hadn't learned anything from the period that he was Labour leader. And I do think that Zahra's return, although she's not a revolutionary, she is much more radical. I disagree with the Spark, by the way, because I think they're wrong to be so cynical, because even when she was Labour MP, she was already making the right noises on some key subjects then. While she was on the Labour benches, and that's why she was clearly targeted in her own COP to get her deselected.
Yeah.
At least twice, and it failed. So perhaps Zahra's return could become a revolutionary at some point. And maybe she might revert back again, and that could be it. That's what you would mean by syncretism in this sense of the word, isn't it? I do think there is a, despite the public displays, I do think when push comes to shove, I do think there are quite big divides between the Zahra Sultana camp and the Jeremy Corbyn camp. And I'm afraid the way people in your party dealt with this whole thing, let's be honest, there's a mix of ageism and misogyny rolled into one, because I have noticed, and I have to say this, because it really gets on my nerves. Every time, Corbyn's team apparently make a mistake. Well, one, I can't forgive him or his team for the fact it doesn't really matter because he employed them anyway. So, I can't forgive him for the fact that they alleged that the initial launch was a scam, and it clearly wasn't. So I find that unforgivable, and I don't think there's ever been a public apology for that, and I would like to see a public apology for that. And I have noticed among those that are more inclined to support Corbyn, there's a tendency to think, well, he makes mistakes, or somebody in his team that did this, and when Zahra Sultana makes a mistake, there's a mentality that says, you stupid girl, you couldn't have done that, and that is flat out misogyny, and I do think that needs to be acknowledged. Mm-hmm. And I'll stop there, but I think myself and Mark A are somewhat on the same page, where your party is concerned at the moment. Thanks.
Mark C.
I was going to say, I always go by a certain rule. If the establishment or the West don't like something, then you can guarantee it's okay. And the other way round, if they hate something, if they like something, then you can guarantee it's not okay. And if they don't like something, you know what I mean. But anyway, so the establishment don't like your party, and they've got a soft spot for the Green Party, so they must be doing something right in your party. A lot of what's going on with your party is some of the misogynism coming out to Zahra Sultana. I think they don't like the fact that there's a very strong woman emerging with some very strong ideas, because there's nobody else in any of the other parties. The ones in Reform are completely, I mean, the Tories, I just don't know where they're going. But there was something else I was going to say as well, but I can't remember what it is now. Oh, yeah, I was going to ask Ian. Ian, do you think that the communist parties sit on the sidelines a little bit too much? It's like they're waiting, sitting in this jar, waiting for somebody to rub the jar so they can pop out every now and again and say something. And there's no kind of, it's not like your party or anything like that. There's no kind of push to really make themselves known. And if you want to join the party, you have to sign loads of paperwork and speak to them on the phone. So they don't even make it easy to do that.
Just on that, I mean, I don't think there is.
Oh, yeah, I love Mark's point about rubbing the jar and hoping that something appears.
I don't think there is a communist party around at the moment. There are various things that profess to be communist parties, but they're all various varieties of somewhat, some are centrist, some are reformist, you know. They're not real communist parties. I think we are a communist nucleus. I think we are very weak, on the other hand. We're very weak in terms of numbers, and we need to politically sharpen up in many ways and whatever. But we're at least trying, you know, on the right lines. There are other people who are not too bad, like the Sparts and the CPGB, but they are not, you know, I think we have better politics than they do, but we don't necessarily have as many forces as they do. It's all a matter of time, isn't it? And the chances we've had for development, which they've had a lot longer than we have, you know. So I don't know. I mean, I think we have to. What we're doing is discussing the correct politics, and all you can do really is elaborate the correct politics, and do your best to win people over to them. I think that's the twin track that we're doing. I mean, I invited a whole load of people to this meeting today, about 10 or 11 other people. Nobody's turned up, unfortunately. It's a bit regrettable. Hopefully we'll just keep trying, and we'll do another educational on this in about a month. I want to do some basic educationals on things like Lenin's short book, The State and Revolution, which I think would be an excellent thing to study. It's not very long. It wouldn't take months and months and months or a year like The Revolution Betrayed. It'd probably take about 3 or 4 months or something, you know. It would be nice to study that. It's not even very big, you know. It's got short chapters, and it's a very crisp, sort of text. And, of course, I've got the whole of Lenin's collected works stashed away in my bookshelf, which I got given to me for free when I was in the BT, you know, because someone I inherited off somebody, you know. But I need to encourage people to read Lenin. There's a lot of stuff about Lenin in the Marxist Internet Archive and available on, you know, in print as well, you know, quite cheaply, I think, you know.
Ian, just quickly, can you confirm again the title of that short Lenin book you were... The State and Revolution.
It was written during the period between February and October 1917, so it's a very important work, you know.
Okay, cheers.
I think it was, anyway, something around that time, you know. But, yeah, I think we should do some stuff like that, you know. Paul?
Yeah, last book, I'm pretty sure that is in the Marxist Internet Archive, so it wouldn't cost anything to acquire copies.
Yeah.
So it is there, I think. So, and I'd like to study that one as well. I think I read that when I was working. It's actually quite a short book, isn't it, in relative terms?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Susan?
Okay, one of the things that cropped up at the conference that I was at yesterday is the massive influx of AI. And I know that you know a lot about a huge amount of IT. And what I was going to say is, can we also do... some sort of information and education on what AI and the ID cards that Starmer and is so keen to introduce, that what was you know, Tony Blair's pet project back in the 2000s, and what it will mean for us in the future going forwards, because it's a word, it turns up, it is going to mean all sorts of things, but it would be really nice to have a discussion on what we think it is, what it's likely to be, and try and bring where, you know, I've got some experience of it because of where it is now going. Government policy is to introduce it into teaching. Anyone who is on PIP or anyone who is on benefits or anyone who is on pensions, it is going to affect them in terms of the ID cards and AI. It is going forward, it is going to affect, shall we say, the revolution in terms of its control of our social and our main media. So I'm putting down a challenge. Maybe you'd like to take it on, if that's all right with you, Ian.
Well, just coming back on that, I am not an expert on AI. I need to study it myself for part of my job. And I'm probably a bit backward in it, to be honest. I need to catch up on some of the...
But I'm just saying, you have more of a hope of tackling it than... Unless you know, if you know somebody who is, you know, willing to come and talk to us and well, we can question.
I might be able to talk to you myself if I do a bit of studying on it. But at the moment, I think maybe Diana knows more about it. I don't know. You know.
But anyway, I'm just asking because I think it's something that politically we should be aware of. Okay.
Paul and then Diana.
But anyway, thank you for listening.
And I think we should actually wind up fairly soon as well, but yeah.
I probably have a slightly different position on AI, although I'm aware of the environmental damage, but I'm also aware how useful it is as a tool. So that's my personal experience of AI, but on the subject of this discussion, though, Ian, I don't know if you've had another chance to look at that CR James essay, but about the one about Sortition and Greek democracy. If it's okay with you at some point, I would like to do a thought on Sortition based on that essay. And that is actually the discussion that's been going on with your party, because some are in favour of it, some aren't. I actually quite like the idea, because I've noticed that the arguments against it, when you boil it down, it tends to come from a position of mistrust of the MAP membership. And, and that sort of thing. And I don't have a real understanding of how it works. And I would like to do a talk on, based on, CRW.
CLRJ.
Yeah.
Okay. Do that in a couple of weeks, and I'll think about doing something on centrism, and then we'll start studying revolution. How about that for a plan?
It's a controversial topic, admittedly, because we're only used to it in terms of jury service. I'm fascinated by the whole concept. Okay. So I would like to use the essay to give a short talk and see where we go from here.
Okay. Well, why don't we do it in 2 weeks?
I might look into Greek democracy further. Mm-hmm. I am interested in it.
Okay. Diana?
I think what Paul said about the sortition thing and the talk on it, that sounds interesting. I'm not volunteering to do a presentation on it, but I did study an OU module in natural and artificial intelligence, but that was in 2012, so
right.
Slightly out of date, although a lot of the principles, particularly the mathematics behind neural nets, won't have changed. Mm. What was I going to say about it? Oh, yeah, in computing, you all know this, Ian, the saying, garbage in, garbage out.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Well, with AI and, you get these, you get these large databases that the AI software refers to do training on. So I would say stupid prejudices in, stupid prejudices out.
Yeah, indeed.
With AI, yeah. And that is happening.
Can we wind up now, yeah? If that's all right. Because it's getting on for 20 past six. And I think we've been on talking for about 2 hours. So won't we meet in 2 weeks' time? We can do Paul's thing on CLR James and Greek democracy and sortition and things like that, yeah? Is that acceptable?
Yes.
If it's acceptable with Paul in 2 weeks' time, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway.
Okay,
all the best.
Right.
And thank you again. Thank you again, Paul, for putting yourself on the spot.
Yeah.
And Ian for chairing. Okay.
Yeah, well done, Paul.
Okay. Take care.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye.